Hello and welcome to the program yet again. My name is Luke Hunt. This is Beyond the Mekong, and with me today is Father John Murray, who prefers to be called John. John has been with Caritas in Thailand since about 2005 and has done a lot of work with the refugees coming out of Burma. John, welcome to the program.
Thank you very much.
How has the situation changed over the last couple of years? The revolution has obviously completely overhauled what you would do, one would imagine.
Well, changed firstly because of COVID.
Mm-hmm.
You already had years of a huge number of Burmese migrant workers in Thailand. That's easily, say, 3 million. Only half of them were here officially or regularly documented, so they would always say double the number, so that would take it up to 3 million. Of course, they were here because of what was not there or there in Myanmar, and they'd always say, no matter how bad things were here for them, they'd say it's better than back home. They have opportunity here, make money. And then COVID hit, and when COVID hit, the Thai government closed the borders, and they were given a short amount of time to go home. Of course, a number stayed or got caught, and then they were left in limbo, and even maybe closed off in open camp areas, and say without food or money. But something that happened during that time was that good-hearted, kind Thai people would come and give them food. Right. So there was already COVID. And then during COVID, the coup arose, 1st of February 2021. And that changed it totally because it developed into an internal war. And I remember time and again being told, and I read it now consistently, it's named as a revolution because I'm told that we're not fighting each other, we're fighting the military,
mm-hmm.
and we're not fighting our fellow citizens. And of course that's changed it totally, because ones who are already here can't or don't want to go back, and right. The situation's changing. Are they required to go back because of the nature of if they have to renew their passports or even their visas?
The pink card.
Yeah, and the Thai government is saying, well, because of government, well, I won't say government, because of the junta regulations in Myanmar, you have to maybe go back.
Mm-hmm.
So it's changed totally because there are many, many more. They want to flee. They need to flee. And what do? Because they're not being recognized as refugees. They're allowed in by the Thai military short term. And then they're pushed back when they say it's safe to go back. But it's very unsafe there. And so you have, I think, a greater mingling of the population of people from Myanmar and Thailand. You have more who are sort of, I would say, mingling into the huge population of Burmese already here going for work. You have others stuck at the border or settling at the border, forming themselves into groups, organisations, looking after each other. And then you have a number of people, a number of groups, I hear the Burmese say, living in the jungle.
Right.
So you've got all these different groups, and they're big numbers.
And a lot of it's socio-economics as well. I mean, I know there are a lot of Burmese in Cambodia, for instance, so they've come through here, used their passports, gone to Cambodia. They can get I think it costs them about $500 a year. You can get a one-year visa and a work permit if you've got a job. And if they're educated, a lot of them work for telecom companies, so if they're educated and they can qualify and get a job, then they're okay. They're more on the, you know, they're migrants.
Yeah.
Sort of, because if you speak to them, they're all fleeing the war. And what happens to those who don't have a skill set, the ones who do come from those villages which are incredibly poor? Where do they go?
Well, you've got to survive. And there is, I know through my church connections in Myanmar, they're concerned about a vulnerable group, which would be the younger Burmese who have come here and aren't as well connected or resourced. So that's true. So it's about NGOs and others trying to reach out to the whole community, and within the community, establishing who are the vulnerable ones. That's the best way to go, is you address the whole community, and then within the community you find the vulnerable ones, right, within the community. If you go for specific groups, you could get into bad practices, or practices that are sort of nearly judgmental.
Well, I think the NGO world has changed too over the last 10, 20 years. There was a time post-Cold War almost where governments threw money at NGOs and great packages, and they went off there to do their thing, carry their agenda forth. Now it's a lot tighter. The money's not in NGO work as it once was.
Well, you're getting into other issues there too, yeah, because number one, and I mean this in the most positive way,
mm-hmm,
anybody who's smart and wants to conform an NGO, in days gone by, they probably would have become a member of a church and worked in some church group or in some UN agency, yep, or something. But people at the grassroots level who want to help, and I see there's the other thing is the rising up of more NGOs, mm-hmm, like you know yourself, I think, in Mer Sot,
yep,
amongst the Myanmar. One of the things that's happening in this country, which is not unique to this country, is they have been talking about new legislation, which would be about limiting foreign investment in NGOs or overseeing it.
Right.
And that's seen as something that could be quite dangerous, because it could give government control determined by, shall we say, government interests rather than the interests and the needs of the people.
Right.
So if you have American money coming into an NGO to help Burmese hiding in the jungle,
mm-hmm,
now that money's maybe not so tracked, but if it's tracked by the government and they say, who's sending this and what's it for, that can alert them and maybe more likely say, well, we don't want this to happen.
Right.
Because it's helping Burmese at the border can be very political.
Mm-hmm.
So that I know that, for instance, amongst, well, at least in the church, if you're a foreigner, you don't want to be seen doing hands-on. But if you're Thai or other Burmese, it's a lot freer in what you can do.
A lot more acceptable.
Yeah.
So.
And that's part of the change too, because this is a revolution, a war, and the Thai military, in part I understand their stance. It's not, well, I was going to say it's not exactly Trumpite politics, but maybe I shouldn't have said that. their stance is they want to protect their border, and they don't want to have another uprise in refugees. They don't want to deal with it. I suppose, to be fair to them, they feel that or see that we've been doing this for so long, we've had enough. These camps that are along the border,
yeah,
were due to close, and they are working towards that. Then there's the coup and now the revolution. They can't close,
mm-hmm,
but they're saying that those camps, nobody knew to come in.
Right.
But what's happening is, the other thing is that, which I totally understand, what a family's going to do if they live near the border and they don't want their son or daughter raped by the military or conscripted, so they say, get out of here and go to Thailand.
Mm.
And they don't care where they go as long as they're out of there. So there's all these whole, as you said, it's a whole new ball game.
Yeah, it's different, that's for sure. I mean,
we're not just coming to get an extra buck.
Right, and that combination of COVID and the revolution, I've heard a lot of other journalists, NGO workers, diplomats talk about the conflict in Myanmar as if it's, oh, it's just continuing, this is just an extension of what's happened for the last 60 years, and I think they're wrong. I think it's a very different conflict with what's going on now, and given the successes of the anti-regime forces, the junta can't win this war, which uh-huh. means that politics is going to have to be redefined, and that will include, what do you do with the refugees? And I think the last number by the UN, not to be confused with what you said earlier, is that there is now 3 million refugees who have fled the conflict and are in Thailand.
Well, the UN reports I see,
mm-hmm.
my understanding, and anybody out there could tell me that I'm wrong, they don't name them as refugees. They name them as IDPs,
right?
Internally displaced. The UN doesn't want to deal with them as refugees in this situation. I don't know exactly why. I suspect it's because they don't want to offend the Thai government, mm-hmm. and they don't want to get into bad politics.
But it makes no sense either. I remember being in Afghanistan and other countries decades ago, and say Afghan relationships with Pakistan was that in Afghanistan you can't be a refugee because you haven't crossed the border. You're an IDP. You're an internally displaced person. Now, in Thailand, if you cross into Thailand under international law, you should be classified as a refugee.
Yeah, but you're not.
Right.
Neither by the Thai government, nor at least publicly by the UN. UNHCR, at least publicly. They just released guidelines. I have to read them yet. They were last week. I think I got a copy. But so they acknowledge the issue, but I suppose it's how they are able to deal with it or choose to deal with it. I don't.
Or not able to deal with it because...
I don't know.
Right. So the system is not... The system doesn't seem fit for purpose.
Well, you're getting to the bigger issues of why the UN fails.
Right.
Because it's basically it's basically under, would you say, control or the running of world governments.
Yeah.
And if a world government, especially a donor or a powerful world government, doesn't want something to happen, it doesn't happen.
And that goes for all of those countries. I mean, it's a club of nations.
Yes.
We're seeing it play out with Israel and Ukraine as well.
Well, one of the worries here is, that I keep reading and seeing and I'm aware of, is it's definitely not Gaza. Okay, I can appreciate that. But it has its place in those countries of the world with Gaza and Ukraine and Sudan and all the others. But they're worried that it's forgotten. Forgotten or untouched or, you know, too hard to deal with, I think, by whether it's UN or ASEAN. And so there's a sense that I think amongst the Myanmar people that I know, they feel sort of, well, you know what? Something that is consistent. If they want to get somewhere, they have to do it for themselves. So I think they have a real sense, this is my feeling, gut feeling, that we can do this for ourselves and we'll do it, you know, and all the rest, you know.
Yep.
You can't help when you don't want to help, well, we'll still do it.
What are some of the worst cases of refugees you have been seeing over the recent months, given there's been a massive dry season offensive, hundreds of thousands have fled, some have gone back. As I mentioned earlier, the UN has raised its numbers, IDP stroke refugees, if that's what we must call them. What are some of the worst cases that you've seen?
Well, you're talking about individuals.
Yeah.
I suppose where I was last week, the border goes is very porous and goes all the way down Thailand.
Mm-hmm.
So I was up in Mae Hong Song and I saw or came across a small number, but any small number is significant, of people who lost limbs because of landmines.
Yeah.
So they've ended up here and thank God they're able to get care in a hospital in Thailand and they have a very basic, the people have a very basic rehabilitation house, quasi-centre. I suppose this, in terms of real life, I met this incredible young Burmese woman here. I thought she was incredible. And I say this on purpose. She's young, very good looking and very talented. And I say that on purpose. Because of what she was doing on Facebook, she was taken in by the military. And she described what was happening to her while kept in detention. And she wasn't raped, but it was how they threatened her with rape. It was so cruel and inhuman. And so she came here, and she's sort of undercover here, but she continues to use Facebook. So you could look at her Facebook and think, oh, she's just another young, good-looking woman using Facebook. But she's using it to make message.
Right.
It's powerful. She's using the fact that she's young, that she's talented, and a good-looking woman to present a message through her Facebook in support of the revolution. And I think that's the power of the people. I don't know if you know of Sea Junction at Bangkok Art and Cultural Centre.
Okay.
They do a continual number of events and exhibitions and panel discussions on Myanmar. It's very good. And one of their last ones was on the use of art. And
there's quite a bit of that going on too. I was at an exhibition over the weekend. But yeah, please.
Well, this was body art.
Right.
Tapta had nothing else left to use except their body. Does this have sort of do you mind language? But
no,
this
no,
is what
on.
It
it's
said.
Okay. Yeah.
This is what the guy had tattooed on his stomach.
Mm.
Fuck the coup.
Well,
you know, I think that's incredible.
This generation is different, and one of the favourite sayings to differentiate themselves from their fathers and their grandfathers, and given that they did have 8 years of relative peace under Aung San Suu Kyi, despite the other issues, is, their favourite chant is, you pick the wrong generation to fuck with.
Yeah.
You know, so it's they have a very well-defined identity, and art has become a real player in this.
I mean, what is consistent in my work here, I don't know everybody or a lot of people and all that sort of thing, but through my work here with migrant populations and urban refugees, one thing, they have suffered consistently oppression. What is happening now is different. It's of a different nature, and they will win, and it will be game changer. But what is the other thing that has been consistent, I've always been impressed by the young Burmese. They seem smart, capable, and they able to get ahead.
And they're self-taught, and so many of them speak English. And
yeah,
there's those who've studied at college, but then there are those who didn't have those opportunities. And where did you learn your English? And internet. It's all self-taught.
Yeah. One of my great stories with working with Burmese migrant workers was we have, before COVID this stopped because it had to, but we had local learning centres for young migrant workers to go there on Sundays to learn English and Thai and that sort of stuff to help them. I remember being there and there was this young Burmese guy, and he was obviously, I don't know the right time, I'll say obviously gay, and I say this for the point of the story because the English teacher was saying, what is your aim in life? He said, to be a businesswoman. She said, no, in English you're a businessman. And he said, no, I want to be a businesswoman. Oh, that was great.
Gender equality has gone so far these days. I've asked quite a few people this over the last few weeks. How do you think the war will play out? Do you have a prognosis? I know it's difficult, but what's happened over the last few months has been a game changer for how people are viewing Myanmar and where it's going to go.
Well, once again, I know everybody and everything, but I think the bottom line is the Tatmadaw, the military, can't win.
Mm-hmm.
They have a huge playing card, which is jets with bombs.
Yes.
Which is a huge card. But I don't. They won't win because they can't control the hearts of the people. And you see the passion of the people that they're not going to go back to what was.
Right.
And that they're going to have a country without the military, but it's going to be a big question or a big challenge what sort of country that is. And there could be more ongoing fighting or robust discussion.
The robust discussion will be a big point in the years ahead.
The bottom line is, say, federalism, a robust federalism, but some of the ethnic states, they don't want to enter into a federal country, at least at the present time. And you understand that because of what they've suffered. So if your family home has been destroyed, your son has been killed and your daughter raped, you don't want to be part of a country where these people are also fellow citizens. I suppose that's the bottom line.
One of the differentiating factors between the current conflict, which I call a civil war, and previous, is that in the conflicts that followed World War II and decades that followed, there was always this assumption that the Burmese military, or the Barmen, have a special place in Myanmar's society and in government. And that was right through and involved in the peace talks and kept the conflict off the international agenda because it was seen as internal and contained. However, now that is simply unacceptable. You know, what the anti-regime forces love to call a revolution, I don't think they're wrong, is that there is no place for the military at all in a Myanmar society of the future, if that makes sense.
Yeah, I can understand that. But then I suppose that in whatever conflict, you have to eventually come to some sort of negotiation and maybe you have to make decisions you'd rather not make, but that's not pardoning or excusing ultimately people who did very bad things.
Sure.
So all I'm trying to say is, in that, it makes sense to me that it would be a federal state, and that's how I heard a couple of my friends talking before this present conflict.
Yep.
Those same ones now would say no, but maybe with time, settling down, they go for a federal country, and each state could be highly autonomous.
Mm-hmm.
You look at the US or Australia.
I think they're good examples.
I mean, during COVID, it amazed me as an Australian that a state could close the border. I thought that'd be impossible.
Western Australia. Actually, they all did it, really.
Yeah.
I think you're quite right, and it's probably the only realistic political solution for Myanmar going forward.
Some of these ethnic states, some are better resourced than others and bigger than others, but a couple of them that I see, they're landlocked and they're too small. So therefore, if they go on their own and become their own country, that would mean to me they eventually have to become like somehow or other adopted by Thailand or by China.
Right.
Or maybe, I don't think...
Or India Bangladesh wants to, or India.
To be able to survive, to do trade, to be able to live a social life that's in touch with the world.
Right.
Like, you're not going to get an international airport maybe in a capital of an ethnic state.
Yep.
You know, flying planes to New York and Paris.
Well, the sheer logistics of a state like that to establish itself as a country. I mean, you could look at East Timor as an example. It's finally coming together. It is joining ASEAN, but the sheer poverty that was there and the lack of institutions, the lack of infrastructure that you need to have if you're going to be counted as a country in the UN, it's a formidable task for some of these states.
Some of these states in Myanmar do have resources, like hydroelectric power, natural resources.
Minerals in Karen State.
But they've been pirated or raped by the military, but they're there for the people.
Right.
You know, so they do have something. East Timor was sort of at one stage, what would you do?
Indeed, it was a failed state, pretty much.
Yeah.
Well, failed before it became a state. Cambodia was a failed state. How would you like to see the UN and its attitude towards Myanmar? How would you like to see that change, perhaps?
Well, to be fair, I think that especially if they've had their person who's assigned to Myanmar, they're well-intentioned and they try, but there's a brick wall called the military junta.
Mm-hmm. This is, of course, Julie Bishop, the former Australian foreign minister.
The one before her was pretty...
Right.
She was a good woman, too.
Yeah.
So I would think that, well, number one, the ones that I meet time and again, they don't want to become refugees in terms of resettlement and go to America or Canada. They want to go back home to a new Myanmar.
Mm-hmm.
So you, instead of spending, say, maybe a lot of energy and money on treating them as refugees, maybe you look at them within a special category of people who need special attention with the respecting their wishes, which is their wish, to go back home.
Mm-hmm.
You focus your attention and your resources on that.
Perhaps find third
But they need somewhere to stay that's safe.
Right, and so they need third countries.
Yeah.
That could be Australia or Canada or America. It's becoming more obvious that the Thais are less welcoming at a government level. What I've seen at the grassroots levels along the border, the Thais are terrific in the way they've assimilated with Burmese, Myanmarese, and how they've worked in with society along the borders.
India doesn't seem like it's a possibility. No. India's sort of already... But Thailand remains a possibility, but respecting Thai wishes, nearly to have... They say they want refugee camps, but you nearly need to allocate specific spaces that are safe. Because from what I know of Australia as an Australian, I don't think they're going to be accepting a lot of new arrivals, especially when you hear some of the politicians, and it's not just Australia.
Yep.
So I don't agree with it, but then one has to be practical about what's possible. Maybe there's an investment in maybe being, I don't know, you made me think, putting money into, say, leasing land off a government and say, well, can we get a 10-year lease?
That's not a bad idea, and establish a camp. I mean, some of these camps have been dreadful over the years, and given how long people are occupying them, well, why not build these camps into something more livable You can build school. You can put in universities with online courses. You can do all sorts of things, as opposed to setting up tents and leaving them to their own devices.
Well, it's already happening with university-level education. I know that. It just is. It could be opened up more. I'm just going on the basic line that everybody has a right to have a home, even if their country's torn apart by a war. You have a right to have somewhere to live and live safely, no matter who you are or where you come from.
How does Caritas, which is a very well-known organisation, how is that fitting into the system in terms of refugees, war, the governments of Thailand, the junta?
Well, the number of official refugees in Thailand is defined by those living along the border in communities that are already in existence, and that's, say, up to 90,000. And Caritas reaches out to all those people in their communities in terms of livelihood, skills, in terms of education and child protection. But then you've got this whole new big population that's not even defined by space, is they're fleeing a war. And then how do you target them and how do you get to them? That demands a level of creativity. So there, for instance, there are resources available, not to be able to create the perfect world for all these people, but there are resources available to help them. But you have to be creative about how you can do that safely. And it's basically humanitarian assistance, because until the people have somewhere that they can settle and at least name as their home for a short while, how do you get into the other issues like health and education?
Operations inside Myanmar, how are your connections in there?
Well, whether it's the church or otherwise, people live on both sides of the border, and the local people, the Burmese people, are connected, and they're able to get in help across the border if it's just near the border. I suppose the harder part would be if you're in the middle of the country.
Yeah. In the Irrawaddy Basin area, and that axis between Yangon, Mandalay, and Naypyidaw.
So I don't think there's just one size fits all, or there's not just one story. Yeah, it's a complex issue. Like, I haven't been to Yangon for a few years, but they say that since military conscription has been brought in, that Yangon is being depleted of its youth. They're all leaving. And then that will have an effect on the local economy of Yangon and on the industry, because the young people won't be there. That's just one part, but it's complex.
It is. I mean, there's so many ethnic groups. There's 20 ethnic armed organisations plus the PDFs. It is a complicated conflict, to say the least.
So if you're near the border, it's porous, and the local people can take assistance across, but that's basic humanitarian assistance. The issues are bigger and wider in terms of their needs. But like I say, you've got to find a safe home or a place where you can be safe first. And then you talk about the services, education and everything. But you can't always be on the move. You have to be somewhere where you can stay.
Are you finding your operations being complicated by human trafficking? And what's happening with the scam compounds across the border, Shwe Koko, those kinds of places?
In terms of what we do, not really. I know it's very real. In the area of human trafficking, the Catholic Church, for instance, is very small in Thailand, but has quite a strong arm that's involved in anti-human trafficking, because it's obviously it's something the church is very strong against. But what happens there is nearly at an industrial scale. So the church is acting at a personal level, but what's happening there, it's nothing like a whole industry.
It's extraordinary, the scale.
So it's something that needs a response of government and police and full on. I mean, individual cases and everything, whether it's Bangkok or there, but what you're talking about, it's a whole new world in human trafficking.
It has indeed, and it's going to impact on Myanmar, and hence... the final question, what would you like to see happen in regards to Myanmar over the next 2, 3, 4 years, whether it involves the United Nations, Thailand, ASEAN, which we haven't really touched on? How would you like to the leaders of the region to respond?
Well, if you look at the leaders of the region, they already have, I think they call it their five-pillar response. Well, it's about, first off, working hard to put that into practice. But if you've got a brick wall, I suppose the bottom line is you want war to stop, because it really doesn't help anybody except those who are at the very top, the very elite who are profiting from it. But the ordinary citizen on whatever side suffers. So the bottom line is to stop the war, finish the war that's going on. I think that requires some hard-nosed political intervention or negotiation. But I go back to what I said before. It's a forgotten war. China's somehow or other involved in this. Russia's an ally of the junta. But the big powers, and not necessarily just the US, but the big powers with big money, what are they doing to help what's going on there in terms of trying to stop it?
Mm-hmm.
They just don't seem to... There seems to be a big silence.
And those powers could include Australia and Indonesia, who worked quite closely behind the scenes in establishing the Paris Peace Accords for the Cambodians 3 decades ago. And there doesn't seem to be anybody talking to the National Unity Government and the opposition forces, and nor do you hear stories about back-channel negotiations, which once we did, and these kinds of things just don't seem to be happening at all.
Yeah, maybe it's because the world's just not interested. Maybe it's taken over by too many other more important areas, shall we say, overcome by Ukraine, Afghanistan, Gaza.
There's something that needs to be rectified.
Yeah, that's true. I mean, it's more than just Ukraine, it's more than just Gaza. I mean, individuals can't stop this war as such, but individuals can continue fighting it in more ways than one to try and bring it to a resolution. The spirit of the people and their will is very strong.
Father John Murray, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Okay, thank you.